Welcome to the Growing Rural Podcast, where we focus on all things rural in South Carolina. We will discuss topics on healthcare, economy, education, and the unique culture that is our rural state. This podcast is supported by the South Carolina Center for Rural and Primary Healthcare. Please join us for today's topic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Growing Rural Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kevin Bennett. Our guest today is Dr. Jan Eberth. Dr. Eberth is the director of the Rural and Minority Health Research Center and an associate professor at the University of South Carolina. Welcome, Jan.
Thanks.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up here doing what you do.
Well, as you know, I'm an epidemiologist. I'm at the Arnold School of Public Health in the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics, and I've been there since 2013. Mm-hmm. I started working with the center fairly soon after I came to USC under the direction of Jan Probst, our mutual friend and mentor.
And previous podcast guest.
Yes. And in 2015, I became deputy director of the center, and I did that for a few years. So that sort of got my feet wet in what this center was all about, mm-hmm. how to work mm-hmm. in that environment. And when our, when Jan decided to retire, it presented a great opportunity to just keep the center going and all the legacy alive of what she developed over the past almost 20 years now.
Right.
So I've been working with the center as their director since 2018, working closely with your center and others across campus, trying to collaborate and find ways to do things together and sort of instead of silos.
So for those who don't know the center, give us the 2-minute elevator speech on what the center is and what
they
do.
Well, the center is funded by the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy, which is in a division under DHHS called HRSA. Mm-hmm. So a lot of their services are actually in sort of direct service provision. They have grants that help with telehealth. They have grants for rural residency programs or establishing new networks to help rural clinics grow. But they have this one separate research line focused on the research. So they mm-hmm. have some policy analyses, they have a telehealth research center, and they have rural health research centers, which we are one of those centers. And originally it had been funded back in 2001, so it's been going for, like I said, almost 20 years now. The center does policy relevant research and also some advocacy around issues related to health disparities in rural populations. So that's sort of our niche area is, you know, this understanding that rural America is not monolithic, and we want to look within rural areas to see how they differ from one another based on the characteristics of the population that resides in those areas. So if there is a large racial ethnic minority concentration, if there is persistent poverty, you know, what is the characteristics of those counties? So that's sort of our niche areas, focusing on those contextual factors and how they relate to the outcomes of those populations.
So what are some of the, I guess, projects or programs you guys have worked on through the center through the years that folks would be interested in?
Well, we've done a lot of different types of projects, and they're often sort of framed around this topics that FORP is really interested in. So as our funder, they have priorities at the federal level that they're interested in having answered so that policymakers can develop data-informed policies.
So because the federal agency you work with, their mission is to, I guess, inform legislation and policymakers and actually do something about it, right?
Yeah, they partner a lot with organizations like National Rural Health Association. They're not directly informing the policies themselves, but the data that the centers collect in those empirical studies can be really helpful for them, not only in making policies, but even coming up with the next grant program, making sure that those grant programs are best aligned with where there's need. So some of the studies that our center has done, we've done some work on childhood outcomes. So there's childhood trauma, childhood mortality, looking at trends over time. We've looked at HIV and AIDS, which, you know, if you think about the Ryan White program, for example, like a lot of the clinics are not located in rural areas. There is, even though small population size in rural areas, they can often be more at risk because of their lack of having the care centers available, testing sites available. There's just not funding, you know, going to those areas because they're not high population centers.
And I think there was a recent New York Times article about HIV in rural, how it's growing, the rate of increase is increasing.
And you can see, you know, a case study or example of like what happened in Indiana being a really you know, foretelling experience, like what other rural communities might face if these workforce issues aren't worked out. And also policies put in place to help stem the epidemics before they happen.
Right.
So that can be related to, you know, needle exchange programs. It can be related to making sure you have testing sites available, even drugs, you know, like because it's often associated with drug use. So, you know, even the funds that are going towards opioids might have an impact on rural HIV. A positive impact, exactly. Some of the other work we've done, like this year, for example, we're looking at the impact of rural hospital closures, which is, you know, something that other centers have focused on as well. But one of the unique angles we're taking is we're looking to see how those rural hospital closures impact the primary care safety net. So not how it impacts, you know, the distance to the next closest hospital, but do FQHCs or rural health clinics suffer as a result? You know, do those clinics have to take on more patients than maybe they're able to take on? Or vice versa, maybe it's seen as a benefit that they can expand their programs and include other types of services that they didn't originally. So that's the question we're going to be digging into this year.
Good. Yeah. And I'm working with a hospital here in South Carolina that's trying to do just that.
Awesome.
But the problem is resources. They need an infusion of cash to try to get that going to make themselves financially stable. So it's a catch-22.
Yeah, yeah, I can understand that. I mean, I think the programs that HRSA has in place can often be helpful for, you know, FQHCs, for example, expanding sites. But there's also a lot of organizations, like even free medical clinics, that don't have a steady source of cash that are able to try to help in these situations. And there's also new program models like freestanding emergency room units. And they're, you know, testing a lot of innovative types of delivery designs because of the shortage with hospitals.
And different payment models to help support them.
So that's our goal, is to like look at these new models and look at the workforce changes over time and try to help inform the, you know, the policies that would be, that would make sense for the situation, which are going to vary locally. So it's what happens in one place isn't what's happening everywhere else. And we need to shed light on that more.
Right. So you talked about HRSA and FORP, you know, being the, I guess, the forefront of rural research and delivery support. Are other agencies getting more involved with in rural over the past few years?
Yeah, I think there has been a renewed interest in rural health across a lot of the agencies in the federal government, not just health-related even. You know, housing is another great example. But within the health space, I've definitely seen some changes in the National Institutes of Health, for example. They have several grant programs that have come out just in the past few years. So as a cancer researcher, I can tell you specifically from the cancer angle more so than I can some of the other angles because that's, you know, the area of my work.
Right.
So the National Cancer Institute is where I have submitted a lot of my grants, and they in the past few years have made rural health a huge priority. So they have research emphasis areas that they strategically plan. What are our research emphasis areas over the next, you know, 5 or 10 years?
Right.
And rural health or rural cancer control is one of those research emphasis areas for the entire.
Okay. And why do you think that is? Why do you think they came
Yeah,
upon
I think
that?
It's a good question. I honestly think that it was the result of seeing some of the data that came out showing that, you know, I think rural populations had been kind of overlooked in a lot of empirical studies for a long time. We had looked at racial ethnic disparities. We'd even looked at sort of geographic differences by things like state.
Right.
But we hadn't delved into, well, what about within state differences? And are those differences related to the urban-rural designation of those areas? And once those sort of seminal studies started coming out, which was only, you know, 5 years ago, basically, those studies started coming out showing there are major differences in who's getting cancer, who's dying from cancer. And, you know, it was unfortunate to see that rural populations were often, you know, getting the greatest burden of they have higher rates of smoking, more late stage cancers, higher mortality rates for most cancers. So it was a wake up call to NCI to say, well, you know, not only is their data now supporting this, but when they looked at their own funding portfolio, they said, hey, we only have 3% of our grants focusing on this important population. So they want to make a change.
Okay. Do you think that there's a trade-off, especially with large national agencies like this, that to overlook it because, yes, it's a higher rate, but it's still a small number? Do you think that bias plays into it as well?
I mean, I think at the federal level, that definitely has played a role for you know,
for years.
For years, right? Because you think about programmatically, oh, we can make the most impact by giving our funds to areas with the most people.
Right.
I mean, it's just a
the most
person-centric bias, you know, the more persons, the more, you know, ROI is what they're thinking. But I think it's shifted because just like when we initially began looking at racial ethnic disparities, you know, decades ago, it wasn't, rural minority populations were small too. You know, they are small. Now they're growing. Obviously, when you look at the overall percent of the population now that is non-white, it is growing. But in certain parts of the country, it's, you know, still less than 5% even. So, I mean, there are, it's an interest in focusing on equity to me that I think has changed their focus in a way just from numbers of persons and sort of this ROI perspective to, well, what's the best thing to do from a social justice perspective? I'd like to hope that that trend continues.
Yeah, trying to get everybody equal access and opportunity for their care.
And I think for these rural areas, you know, you're thinking of the terminology you used with equal access. But in reality, there's quite a difference between sort of equality and equity. And we may need to give more attention and care to these areas to get them back up to the level of equality. So even if we're providing equal level of services, that may not be enough. We may need to go the extra step above and make sure
there's
more.
Higher disease burden or a higher need to address. Because they've been left behind for so long. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And so although NCI is national, they have invested in our state to do some great work around cancer prevention and control. So in 2018, they provided us funds to do a statewide environmental scan to look at what rural health clinics, what FQHCs and hospitals were doing around this. So we've been doing surveys and interviews with providers and with other stakeholders who are in rural areas to better understand what are the things going on that are keeping us from having the best high-quality care for rural patients.
So, like, what are the barriers and problems and those kinds of things?
But also facilitators. So there may be things that rural communities have that are unique to them, even in terms of, like, the social structures, the civic engagement of their communities and churches that could be beneficial. So we're
looking at something they've done well that has worked. And
we're looking at both those barriers and facilitators. And we've done a lot of national studies, too, looking at things like financial hardship of cancer patients. But this in-state stuff was is really impactful because it's going to help us develop interventions that make sense for our state rather than just sort of looking at the trends nationally.
Because there's a lot that's unique about South Carolina that would be nice to dive into.
I mean, our population in South Carolina, we have a very large proportion of African-American residents in rural South Carolina, which is unique to many of the southern states. So compared to other parts of the country that are, when you look at their rural populations. So we have to consider what our population is like. Both culturally, we have to think about, well, what about insurance? Do we have adequate insurance for these folks to get care they need? And we have a very you know, high uninsurance and high poverty rates in our rural community. So we really need to find strategies to make sure that they still have access to screening. And more importantly, well, what if you find something during screening? Because screening is often really cheap or even subsidized by federal programs, but treatment can be so expensive.
Yeah, I know we have several programs here in the state for things like mammography and breast cancer screening, but there's not necessarily funding on the back end for treatment. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, I think there are a lot of unique ways that organizations have tried to facilitate and navigate people into care programs like charity care. And just through relationship building with physicians, trying to have them donate some of their time to doing these. I mean, it's all very ad hoc. But I mean, it's better than nothing. I'm glad that the physicians have been so amenable to doing that for many of these patients. It'd be great if we had some systematic programs or some policies that helped address that. So a great case that you brought up earlier was breast cancer. So in our state, you know, not only can you get free breast cancer screening if you're uninsured, low income, or have a high deductible plan through the Best Chance Network program, but if you were found to have breast cancer, then you could be eligible for a Medicaid waiver. So there are these great programs like that.
It's kind of a carve out.
It's not, you know, Medicaid expansion, but these waiver programs allow people who get cancer to have, you know, good treatment at a lower cost. So you know, I'd love to see our state expand to doing these programs in other types of cancers other than just breast and cervical.
Right, because it's not for lung or prostate or any other cancers at the moment.
Lung cancer, for example, that's our number one source of cancer death in our state and in every state.
Right.
It kills more people than breast, prostate, and colorectal combined.
Right, which most people would not think that, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think people, you often don't know of lung cancer survivors because the rate is so low of people who can live past 5 years.
Okay.
Most lung cancers are caught late. And so when you sort of see these campaigns around empowerment of cancer survivors and cancer survivors going and talking to their legislators about the importance of programs, lung cancer survivors are often not part of those groups because they aren't surviving long enough.
Okay.
So we've really got to do, and I think we are doing better in just the past few years. Now we have an effective test to screen for lung cancer using a low-dose CT scan. So we're seeing a stage shift, more people coming in early when cancer is treatable. And now, you know, we're going to have some survivors that can really speak to the value.
Become more visible.
Exactly.
So this screening is relatively new, you said?
Yeah. So only in 2013 did the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force start recommending lung cancer screening. Before that, there was no real evidence-based approaches that we knew about.
Okay.
It's very new, so public awareness is still low. I'd love to, you know, get people in this audience to know more about it, both, you know, the public listening, but also providers, because they have to refer the patients to the screening programs.
Right.
It's not something that patients can just refer themselves to.
Right.
It's really using the provider as that gateway.
And it's primarily for people probably who have some sort of risk, I would imagine.
Yeah. Unlike, you know, breast cancer screening where all women of a certain age are eligible.
Right.
Lung cancer screening has a more unique risk benefit profile.
Okay.
So not everybody should go get it.
So I shouldn't go out and get it probably.
No. You want to be the right age. So you're looking at people 55 to 80 is really a great age to do it.
Okay.
And also people that are high risk. So high risk means that you've smoked a long time.
Okay.
Might be one pack of cigarettes for 30 years, two packs for 15 years. That
so
equates
it's that exposure.
To it. Yeah, exactly. It's the amount that you've smoked, because that increases the risk for people. They also, if you have like a family history or occupational exposures from asbestos and radon, those
certain
are other
things,
risk factors you could consider.
Okay. But your physician provider should know what that is.
Definitely.
If they're aware of the
new
guidelines, right?
Yeah, so stay abreast with those Preventive Service Task Force guidelines. That's really like our gold standard. And I think physicians are aware and following those.
Okay.
But we just need to, you know, it's so new.
Right.
It takes a while for any technology or new guideline to become... standard practice.
Right. So do you have a sense across the state about the number of providers who are appropriately referring patients out or
I wish
uptake?
I did.
Okay.
So we have no data even at our state level about the real proportion of people who are eligible and have been screened.
Right.
The American Lung Association came out with a report just a couple weeks ago that basically said every state was somewhere between, you know, 2% and 8%. I mean, everybody is still very low.
Right.
But in 2019, the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey, which is BRFIS, as some people call it, they are going to be asking a question in our state. So we'll have state-level data.
Some better surveillance.
Yeah.
Okay,
On this issue.
And I would imagine, you said it was a low-dose CT scan, right?
That's right.
That would probably mean it's a little bit less accessible for rural folks, right?
Well, yes and no, because a lot of hospitals, even in rural areas, like critical access hospitals, have CT machines.
Okay.
They may not have organized lung cancer screening programs up and running.
But they have the capability to do it if they do it.
There's a capability there. You know, if you think about getting a program together and making sure that you follow some best practices. And so those that are interested in those type of programs and wanting to get started, I would definitely say, you know, reach out to me.
Right.
I have some resources that I could send people. I have great colleagues that are radiologists and other stakeholders in the lung cancer research space. So we have a lot of resources to help hospitals get up and running.
Okay.
And even if you're not willing to run your own program, create a referral network.
Right.
You know, there are over 30 programs already in the state.
Okay.
So there's definitely an opportunity to in one way or another, right. At your place or somewhere else,
right,
to get people that screen.
At least there's some supply out there to try to meet the demand.
And it's growing. Yes. Okay.
What else do you guys have coming up that you're excited about working on?
Well, we were recently funded for a Rural Innovations Grant through your center to do some really good work with rural health clinics. And we're very excited about this. It's up and coming. We're going to be working with the stakeholders that we identified during this statewide needs assessment process for rural cancer control to help develop and implement intervention in rural health clinics. So many interventions for cancer happen in hospitals and FQHCs because they have more resources.
Right.
But rural health clinics is where it's at, right? Like they're where patients go. They're where primary care happens every day. And that's where screening referrals should be initiated from is in those settings. And some screenings can take place even in the clinic setting, right? So pap smears, for example, things like that.
Some breast exams and those kinds of things.
Exactly. So we want to work with those providers and that have often been left out of the process. We know so much now about what works, you know, what are the different evidence-based interventions that will help increase screening rates. And rural areas of South Carolina do have lower screening rates for most cancers. So this will give us an opportunity to work with those rural health clinics directly, give them some technical assistance, helping them get the interventions up and running in their clinic. We're going to have a sort of champions training where we bring those providers to a setting all together where we work with them to see what the best evidence is. We talk about how to be a champion for screening in your practice. What are the interventions that are most feasible for you? Because it may not be the same for every clinic.
Like what it would look like for them on in direct application.
How to measure your success of your program. So I'm real excited about getting started, and we'll probably be recruiting very soon for the program. So hopefully some rural health clinics in the state, if they're interested, will participate.
Absolutely. So look for that if you're out there. And that sounds good, because that's a direct benefit to our rural residents, because you're trying to get screening increased that they might not have had access to before.
Yeah, we'll be working with the State Office of Rural Health as well for this. So we're excited to have so many good partners to help with recruitment and dissemination of the work.
Are there any other programs like that that are, I guess, helping to improve cancer screening, care delivery, et cetera, for the rural state?
Yeah, I mean, there are some programs out there. For colorectal, for example, we have the Colorectal Cancer Prevention Network, which also is sort of co-funded or are working with DHEC as well as the university. So that program provides open access, you know, no cost to the patients, colonoscopies through a board-certified gastroenterologist all over the state, and many rural patients have taken advantage of that program. They have to be uninsured and meet some income guidelines. But it's a wonderful resource because it touches almost every part of the state, that program does, and they serve hundreds of people every year. So that's a wonderful way, you know, not just to implement intervention to increase screening, but to do the screening
actually
people who need it.
But is there still a gap after that for care if they do find something?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great...
There's not a Medicaid waiver for that population,
We still are looking for that Medicaid waiver to really simplify the process. But the program does have amazing relationships with providers across the state. Access Health has some great relationships with providers across the state to ensure, you know, the surgery and chemotherapy that need to follow.
Kind of get access to that charity care.
It's not ideal, but it's been a good opportunity in the process of trying to get that Medicaid waiver to still ensure those patients get
that
care.
Sounds good. That's great. We've talked a good bit about, I guess, some of these disparities in care or disparities in outcomes for rural. What, in your mind, you've been doing rural for a little while now, I guess. What do you see that's good about rural, especially in South Carolina?
Yeah, one of the programs that we hope to do next year, one of the research areas we want to explore, is these assets directly. There have been some programs that have focused on this in the past. For example, the Appalachian Regional Commission did a project focused on these bright spots. So conceptually, we're interested in looking at the same thing. What are those either civic, public safety, churches, educational programs in the rural areas?
So what resources they already have that you can utilize and help?
Yeah, I mean, you can leverage them for sure. Many of them are not currently doing health-related work, especially, you know, larger churches may have a nurse program, but smaller ones may just not have the capacity to have that. So with the right partnerships, you can bring those to those areas. So we're going to be doing a study to look at those assets in rural South Carolina and help, I think, explore where our next avenues for doing this work are.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds really interesting. Mm-hmm. I always ask my guests how they define rural, so I'm going to ask you that. You work here, here at the university and nationally. Given everything that you've seen, how would you define rural for the common layman's perspective, I guess you could say?
Yeah, so you know the technical definitions, which I won't repeat audience and this question. I think
go back to episode one if you're curious.
Yes, definitely. That was a good episode. I listened to it in preparation for this interview. But I would define it in terms of a few things. So one is just proximity. Mm-hmm. Like, how close are you to a city? Mm-hmm. That's one element. Another is sort of the commuting patterns, right? Mm-hmm. So do people in your area have to travel to another place to work? Mm-hmm. Or not have to, but typically, you know, large proportion of people in your area have to commute somewhere else for work.
Right.
That's often an indicator of being rural. And the last is size. Mm-hmm. You know, some combination of these things, whether you commute, size, and proximity seem to be the three things that are the trifecta of rural.
Right.
And, you know, depending on the definition you want to use, one of those three things may be more important than the other.
Right.
But I think, you know, a somewhat small size, a need to commute mm-hmm. to go to work, mm-hmm. and, you know, living a decent portion away from a large city are the major things that indicate rurality.
Yeah, I think that would triangulate you there pretty well, cover most of our rural
places.
Yeah,
and I think you've got some weird situations where you have really small populations being defined as urban at the federal level because of some of these three
things. Usually one of those factors, right?
Exactly, like, you know, commuting patterns. Well, they all have to commute because there's no work there, or whatever the situation is that they're automatically sort of considered urban. And it's usually doesn't feel very urban in those places. Right. They would argue with you that it's not urban.
It doesn't pass the face test, so to speak. Yeah. Well, thank you, Jan, for your time. This has been very informative. Hopefully someone out there has learned something, and maybe we can get some of these screening programs off the ground and get some more people screened for cancer and prevent some morbidity and mortality.
Definitely. I think there's a long way to go, but we're on the right trajectory.
Right.
So thanks for having me on, and I'm happy to help in any way. Please see the show notes to find out where you can find out more information about these different programs and my contact information if you want to talk more about lung cancer screening programs and how to get started.
Right. So check our show notes for those links and for that information. And stay tuned for more episodes coming out soon. If you've liked what you've heard, please head over to iTunes and leave us a rating. That really helps us get more listeners and get the word out better. And if you have ideas for guests you'd like to hear on our program, please let us know. We'd love to hear from you. That's all for today.
Thanks for listening to the Growing Rural Podcast. If you found the content valuable, please leave a rating on iTunes or Spotify so others can find us. For more information, please visit our website at sc.edu/ruralhealthcare or follow us on Twitter at sc_CRPH. This was recorded at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine in Columbia. It is edited and produced by Sean Riffle. Y'all take care.